Welcome in to You're the Cure right here on AM 580 and 95.9 FM. You're the Cure with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, brought to you by Veritas Medical. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com. You can go there, check out past archived programs and other important medical information about our practice at veritasmedical.com. Check it out. Let me say good morning once again to Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Hey, Wade. I'm great. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Hope you had a great weekend.
I did.
Good. Good deal. Glad to have you back on this edition of You're the Cure. And as always, we always like to have great guests on the program, and so we have a great one today, that's for sure.
Yes, we do. We've, again, just trying to educate not only our patients, but obviously the general public who listen to. And our philosophy at Veritas Medical is that the body has an amazing healing capacity if you just get out of the way. If you just give the body what it needs,
right,
and avoid what it doesn't need, it should function like a well-tuned machine. It's an amazingly designed piece of physiology. Unfortunately, man in his wisdom comes in and oftentimes does so many things that are short-sighted or for the wrong motives, and they're detrimental to our health. So it's awesome to work with patients who get well from diseases they're not supposed to get well from. And I wish I could take some credit for that. But what we continually preach to every patient who's looking to come to our clinic is we don't have any magic potions or pills or special cures that we're formulating. We're simply teaching people how to give the body what it needs and avoid what it doesn't. And in the category of avoid what it doesn't, it can be a difficult one because people have been, I don't know if I should use the word brainwashed, but definitely educated in one point of view that maybe wasn't the full truth or the full story. So when we say stuff like you really should try to eat organically because it's going to have less Roundup on it, less glyphosate, the main ingredient Roundup, but we're in Roundup ready cotton central out here in West Texas, and there's Roundup distributors and salesmen knocking on every cotton gin door around here, so, and telling farmers that no, it's fine, you can drink this stuff, and we're not talking about glyphosate today. I'm just setting up the show, but real quick, I do have to mention, because I just read this headline this weekend, largest settlement in pharma history, Bayer Monsanto agrees to $10 billion with a B settlement with victims poisoned by Roundup weed killer. And, you know, we used to say the same thing about DDT. It's safe. Just go get your little spray of DDT to keep the mosquitoes away. Doctors in the Journal of American Medical Association back in the 50s, there used to be advertisements by doctors about what their favorite brand of cigarettes was, because it was healthy for you. It's good for your lungs. So we have a history of using chemicals in our environment or in our bodies that turned out to be not the best thing for us, or even deadly. Those chemicals, fluoride that people think is necessary and needed for their teeth to be healthy. I'm so excited to have what I'd consider the world's expert on fluoridation and fluoride with us today, Professor Paul Conant. And Professor Conant is a professor emeritus in environmental chemistry at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York. And for the past 30 years, Paul has put his scientific knowledge to work by helping communities around the world understand the science of controversial issues like fluoridation, because the public health officials over the years and dentists and doctors and just people have been preaching that fluoride's fine. There's nothing wrong with fluoride. It's beneficial for your teeth, and it's not harmful in any other way, and I think that's what your average person on the street thinks. So fluoride, in fact, is not innocuous, and it can be one of those things that we need to get out of the body in order for it to function properly and in order for people to get well. So, Professor Paul Conant, welcome to the show. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Ben. I'm excited to be on your show, especially at this time. It's a critical moment in our fight against water fluoridation.
Well, I know it is, and I definitely want to get to that, and we could start with that if we want to, because I've been reviewing fluoride, obviously, in preparation for the show and watching some of your videos, and one thing that struck me was you've been out there preaching this message for years. I mean, one of the videos I saw was, I think, 16 years ago. So it's been a long, long battle, and it's kind of appears to maybe be coming to an end. So let's just maybe touch on that, but then I want to go back and hit your get your historical, you know, how you got into this and kind of the timeline that brought us up to this date. But if you want to give people a little teaser on what's happening in today's world as far as fluoride goes.
Well, yes, I would. A few days ago, we essentially completed the first stage of a trial in San Francisco, or it was via Zoom, but it was the judge was in San Francisco. We have sued the Fluoride Action Network, along with a few other groups, Food and Water Watch, Mums Against Fluoridation, and some individuals, have sued the EPA under TSCA, the Toxic Substances and Control Act, which allows, has a provision in this act to petition the EPA to ban the specific use of a specific chemical if it poses an unreasonable risk to the general population or even just subsets of the population. And we did that for fluoride. We did first petition the EPA to do this, to stop the deliberate addition of fluoride to the drinking water. And after they had 90 days to review our petition, they rejected the petition, they said, on scientific grounds, which allowed us then to take the issue to federal court, to ask the federal court to decide whether the EPA's science on fluoride was better than our science on fluoride. And the specific issue that we were concerned about is fluoride's potential to damage the brain, that fluoride is neurotoxic. And we brought to the EPA literally hundreds of animal studies and at least 64 human studies, which shows that fluoride damages the developing brain in a variety of ways. It lowers IQ in children. It increases the incidence of ADHD and maybe other things as well. But our case was concluded on June the 17th. There were 7 days. We had about 4 days. The Fluoride Action Network had 4 days to present our testimony. We had some of the best experts in the world that have done some of the best neurotoxicity epidemiological studies. And the EPA, it's funny you should mention Roundup, because the EPA used a firm called Exponent, experts from Exponent. And Exponent is usually industry's go-to company to defend all their toxics, including glyphosate. And I think this, one of the scientists that the EPA used from Exponent to protect, to defend fluoride was Ellen Chang. And she actually was also in the glyphosate case, if my memory serves me correctly. So it's extraordinary. We had some of the best experts in the world, and they used experts that are usually defending industry, usually opposing the EPA. And you could think of that, the irony of the EPA not using its own in-house experts to argue the science, but using scientists which are usually defending industry against the EPA. Anyway, at the end of this trial, the judge has not made his ruling yet. What he did is to say, basically, there's no question that fluoride is a neurotoxic hazard. He said that's not debatable. And then he went on to say that the studies that we were using, that it lowered IQ, were very rigorous studies. We all agree that these are the best studies, etc. And then, so if, in other words, he gave us a good indication that we were winning. And secondly, he said to the EPA, you are being demanding too much. You're applying the wrong standard. You're asking for causation. You want the citizens to prove that fluoride causes this rather than is associated with, rather than presenting an unreasonable risk. It's a risk that you have to show, not an absolute proof, because that's nonsense. You can't do that with epidemiological study. And he then said, I want you parties to go away, see if you can come up with some kind of agreement, a resolution amongst yourselves, and if you can't, then I rule on it. So we are very confident that we tried to negotiate with the EPA. They're not very forthcoming at the moment. We're pretty confident we're going to win this ruling. Then the ruling will be a federal law judge, if he rules in our favor, it will be that adding fluoride to the drinking water poses an unreasonable risk to the general population of children, and especially to children who are have more exposure than others, particularly the fetus, because fluoride actually passes through the placenta, gets into the fetus during fetal development, and then bottle-fed. Bottle-fed infants get the highest dose of fluoride in our society after the fetus. So these are two subsets, if you like, fetus and the breast bottle-fed infant. Mm. So that's where we are at the moment. And now to go back historically, I got involved in 1996 when my wife put a bunch of papers on my desk and said, Paul, would you read these? I said, what is it? She said, fluoridation. I said, oh, take that away. These people are crazy. So I had, you know, fallen victim to the brainwashing that you described at the beginning of the program. The brainwashing was that people opposed to fluoridation are flat earth society, nincompoops, unscientific, emotional, all that kind of claptrap, which is since I found out, having written a book on the subject, that this is all contrived. It was a deliberate ploy to try to characterize the opponents this way, because they've never had the science. Even when the U.S. Public Health Service endorsed water fluoridation in 1950, they hadn't concluded a single study. They had virtually no health studies on the table when the U.S. Public Health Service says to the whole country, go ahead and add this fluoride, this toxic substance to your drinking water to protect children's teeth. Anyway, so my wife did persuade me to read these papers, and I was absolutely shocked on several fronts. One of them is very relevant. The first front was I thought that these crazy anti-fluoridation people had confused the element fluorine, which attacks every element in the periodic table except two, even catches fire with asbestos, my goodness, with fluoride, which is akin to confusing chlorine, the gas, the toxic gas used in World War I, with table salt, chloride, chlorine, chloride, fluorine, fluoride. Fluorine and chlorine, very reactive, very dangerous. Fluoride and chloride, I thought, not very dangerous. However, when I started the reading, I found out that fluoride, whilst it's not very reactive from a chemical perspective, from a professor of chemistry's perspective, fluoride, if you put it on the shelf in a glass jar, will sit there for 100 years. It won't react with anything. However, it's biologically extremely active. And I've since discovered that lower creatures have defense mechanisms against naturally occurring fluoride. The bacteria and certain fungi have pumps, protein pumps, which pump excess fluoride out of their tissues to protect them from fluoride. There is no known system in the body, no protein, no enzyme, no nothing, which requires fluoride to perform adequately in the human body. The only benefit that they've referred to is protecting the teeth, but that turns out to be a topical mechanism, not a systemic mechanism. You don't have to swallow fluoride. You don't have to expose every tissue, every system in the body to get this benefit such that may exist. It's from topical application. So if you want fluoride, it makes sense to brush it on your teeth, but then to spit it out and minimize the exposure to other tissues, because it is extremely toxic, reacts, it's just incompatible, essentially, with biochemistry. So I'm jumping ahead of myself. So that was one of the things that I found out in 1996, that fluoride was very, very toxic for biology. Secondly, the level in mother's milk is extremely low. And that's fishy, isn't it? If something was needed, as we were told, for babies, then you would expect to find it in baby's first meal. It's not there. The level in mother's milk today is about 0.04 parts per million. We fluoridate at 1 part per million. which means that a bottle-fed baby in a community where the water level is about one part per million is going to get about 250 times more fluoride than a breastfed baby. So that's, again, one of the concerns that we're now finding. I'll come back to the modern studies in a second. So that was the second thing I found out. And then the other thing, I'm not sure if I found it out on the first day of reading, but it was about that time in 96 that appeared the first two studies in English. There were previous studies in Chinese, but no one had read those. But the first two studies in English, which found an association with between fluoride exposure and lowered IQ in children. And subsequently, there have been now dozens of studies comparing the IQ of children in villages with high fluoride exposure with villages with low exposure. Most of these studies have come from China, a few from India, a couple from Iran, and a few from Mexico, countries with high natural levels of fluoride. And so these first two studies were coming out then. And I remember writing in 96, in one of the first things I wrote was who would put the protection of a child's brain below the protection of a child's teeth? Or put it the other way around. Who would think it was more important to protect a child's tooth, even if it worked, than protecting a child's brain? And it turns out that there are a few people that do actually believe that, and they have the power. The medical and dental associations in the United States, the health agencies, the health departments at state levels, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, all believe or seem to believe that it's more important to protect children's teeth than to protect their brains. Well, that's the way they are behaving. And unfortunately, they have the power, they have the influence, and unfortunately, one of the influences they have is on the media. And as long as the Center of Disease Control continues to parrot, and that's more or less what they are, parrot the notion that fluoridation is one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century, then the New York Times and other agencies will continue to genuflect in front of their statements, which is tragic. It's tragic. So the end result is this, that even though we have well-conducted studies funded by the U.S. government, which shows that fluoride is lowering tooth decay at the levels at which we fluoridate, and also increasing symptoms of ADHD, both in Mexico City and Canada, and these have all been published between 2017 and 2020. There's not a single health agency in this country that is warning pregnant women or parents to bottle feed their babies with fluoridated, using fluoridated tap water. Not one is warning those people. And even if we win this lawsuit and the judge rules that it's poses an unreasonable risk, it will still take us several years with all the foot dragging that the EPA and the other agencies will use to keep this abominable practice going. So that's the beginning. And I brought you up to the present, and perhaps what I need to do now is to fill you in, Ben, on some of the studies, some of the really top-notch studies that we used in our trial and have made available on our webpage. And this would be a good point for any of your listeners to actually go to our webpage, which is fluoridealert.org. Make sure you spell fluoride F-L-U, not F-L-O, F-L-U-O-R, etc., fluoridealert.org. And there you will find 10 trending topics, and they spell out the details of our lawsuit and these critical, at least four critical science studies. And you don't have to read them in huge depth. We summarize the studies, we summarize the significance of these studies in terms of the urgent need to end this foolish practice as quickly as possible.
Paul, before we dive into that, I just have to ask you, because even just in this little bit of time that you've explained all this, I mean, you said over 100 animal studies were presented at the trial, 64 human studies. The judge, obviously, it appears, is quite convinced. And just the little bit you've laid out so far, it seems convincing to me. But then you turn around and say all these governmental agencies are in the exact opposite camp. So I can't, and maybe this is the pessimist to me, but I can't help but conclude there's got to be some sort of conflict of interest or financial interest. And maybe there's not, but could you go back to where this fluoride even came from, this chemical they're adding to the into the water? Is there some potential conflict from a industry profit standpoint?
Yes, there are lots, and it's difficult to pinpoint. And quite frankly, it's the $64,000 question, you know, why? The question why? Why do these agencies support this? Why do they continue to push it, even with this very strong evidence against it? Why? It's a very difficult question to answer, because what you're basically asking for is an irrational situation or an irrational policy. The fact that it works topically, and they admitted that, the CDC admitted that in 1999, from a rational perspective, that was the point to say, well, if you want fluoride, brush it on your teeth. If it works topically, you don't need to force it on people. You don't need to expose every tissue in the body. You can just brush it on your teeth and spit it out and switch from promoting water fluoridation to promoting fluoridated toothpaste or what have you. That would have been a rational thing to do. Then when these studies came out, which shows that fluoride damages the brain, then, of course, that should have stopped it immediately. We have enough evidence for here to remove fluoride from the drinking water, to remove an additive to gasoline or to motor oil or to detergents or something. And we're talking about a substance which, for a pregnant woman, is going to her fetus. The most sensitive period of development is during the fetal stage. Okay, back to your question. Economic, yes. There are economic interests, obvious ones. The phosphate fertilizer industry is getting rid of a hazardous waste, which it can't dump into the sea. It can't dump locally, but if somebody was to buy it from, it becomes a product and they can get rid of it that way. So they take a huge red ticket item, the fluoride waste from the phosphate mining industry, into a money earner, because the public water suppliers are buying this from them, number one. Number two, a big benefactor from fluoridation is the sugar industry, because all the time parents think there's an escape route for tooth decay, namely drinking this fluoridated water or brushing the teeth with fluoridated toothpaste, then they're taking their eyes off the real goal, which is to stop kids from eating so much sugar, drinking soda up the gazoo, which is not only bad in two grounds. You mentioned Monsanto. Monsanto, the inventor, too, of aspartame, which goes into the wretched diet, you know, the sugar-free drinks go from one poison to another. But the sugar lobby, right from the word go, I mentioned earlier that the U.S. Public Health Service endorsed fluoridation in 1950 before any trial had completed. 1 year before that, the sugar lobby had said, we need to find a way to reduce tooth decay without reducing sugar consumption. So the sugar industry has always had an interest in this phony magic bullet called fluoridation, and they have financed a lot of bad research to promote fluoridation and to promote fluoride as a nutrient. So there are another couple of interests. But quite frankly, Ben, I think the reason it continues is that these agencies do not want to lose face. I think they feel that if they lose fluoridation, they will lose the public's trust. And if they lose the public's trust, then the public won't trust them on some other public health practices. And some of those other public health practices are worth billions of dollars. I mean, I don't think that fluoridation is worth a hill of beans from economic points of view. In fact, it's the very opposite. Losing one IQ point loses about, they estimate, something like $15,000 worth of income over a lifetime. So we're talking about losing five IQ points, or say two or three IQ points. You're talking about $45,000 lost income for millions of people in the United States. This adds up to billions upon billions of dollars. It dwarfs any saving that you might get from saving one cavity in a lifetime. But if indeed defending fluoridation is really defending some other public health practices by proxy, and so on. But I actually go back. The real issue is education. And unfortunately, no, I don't know of any dental school in the United States, and if anybody's listening can correct me, I don't know of any dental school in the United States that teaches dental students both sides of this fluoridation debate. Most dental students come out believing that fluoridation is the best thing since sliced bread. And these people that are opposed fluoridation are crazy people. You don't have to listen to them. They're emotional. They're not scientific, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
And to a lesser extent, the same thing applies to medical school. We'll probably not even talk about it in medical school. So
yeah.
Our professionals, and when they, of course, when they graduate, and this is, you know this thing, when you graduate, you've got practices to look after. You can't, you don't have the time to read up on every subject in the world. You might keep up abreast of certain key things in your practice, but not in general. So not many professionals are keeping up with the science that retired professors like me can keep up with on this specific issue. And therefore, they take the words of the professional bodies. And unfortunately, those professional bodies followed like sheep when the U.S. Public Health Service endorsed fluoridation in 1950. Within 2 years, every professional medical and dental and public health body in the United States had also endorsed fluoridation, and they began this entrapped position, entrenched position, where they did not examine the scientific evidence. Instead, they saw their role as promoting and defending this practice ever since. And the final actor in all this is the Center of Disease Oral Health Division, and this is important to make this distinction. The Center of Disease Control is about 30,000 people in Atlanta. They've got every scientist, every discipline under the world protecting our health. But there's only one entity that involves itself with fluoridation, and that's the Oral Health Division. And that's about 30 people, and they are all dentally trained. They're essentially the arm of the ADA. The ADA, the American Dental Association, and the Center of Disease Control Oral Health Division are like Tweedledum and Tweedledee as far as the promotion of fluoridation is concerned. So for the ADA, the CDC is wonderful cover for the practice that they promote.
Mm.
But and it's an illusion for most people out there, including the New York Times. They think that they are hearing from 30,000 scientists who carefully have reviewed this practice to see that it's perfectly safe. And they're not. In fact, one of the most incredible things in our lawsuit is we got testimony from the current director of the Oral Health Division, and he knew nothing. He knew absolutely nothing about the neurotoxicity of fluoride. He hadn't read any of these studies. And Michael, my son, who's the lawyer in this case, had to take him through the National Research Council report that he said that they agreed with from 2006 and point out that the scientists on that National Research Council report of 2006 had actually said that fluoride damages the brain. And he read this out in court, that fluoride damages the brain. The weight of animal evidence, blah, 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 the fluoride damages the brain. But there's a complete disconnect between this admission now and their activities over the last 20 years or so, where they've completely ignored this science. Their job, the Oral Health Division at the CDC, is to promote fluoridation as a health measure, as a public health measure. They do not feel obliged to keep track of the health issues. That is someone else's problem. And what that means, Ben, is no one is in charge of this practice in the United States except the patsy communities that get fooled into doing it.
Wow. Unbelievable. The top people at the CDC is from an oral health and fluoride perspective, or it sounds like clueless.
haven't read the research. You know, it's typical bureaucracies, right? Yeah. To get along, you go along.
And that's who's making decisions that impact, as we see with this COVID-19, which we won't get into. But, I mean, these bureaucracies and these conflicts of interest and these, I mean, for the head guy who's in charge of the fluoride, the CDC doesn't even know. I mean, that's unbelievable. But
and it's similar at the EPA. When we cross-examined again, it was she appeared via video in court. The person at the water division of the EPA, who's supposed to be looking after the safe drinking water standard since the 1990s when she joined the EPA, she again was not very aware of these neurotoxicity studies, had certainly not taken any steps for the water division to readdress the standard, the safe drinking water standard, which is what they were advised to do in 2006 mm-hmm. by the National Research Council. Okay, let me backtrack. In 2003.
Well, before you backtrack, Paul, I'm sorry. We've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll backtrack to that. Also, we had a caller text a question. So when we get back from the break, we'll hit that question, then we'll go into that.
Okay,
We're talking with Professor Paul Conant. Fluoridealert.org is the website. Y'all go check that out. We will be right back. This has been Edwards. You're the Cure.
Welcome back into You're the Cure right here on AM 580 and 95.9 FM. Brought to you by Veritas Medical. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com. Past archive programs, other important medical information, and information about the practice, veritasmedical.com. Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, right here on the show on this Monday. Special guest as well on the program.
Yes, sir. We are back with Professor Paul Conant. Fluoridealert.org is a website you can check out for more information on this topic of fluoridation. We have a quick question on the text line we'll go to, and then we'll get right back at it with Professor Conant.
Okay, so the text is, oh no, municipal water includes both fluoride and chlorine. By the way, we don't use municipal water except bathing, unfortunately. Question and concern, is the water used for commercial products like Topo Chico and LaCroix, etc., harmful if they use that kind of water?
Well, my answer would be it just depends on the source. I don't know in LaCroix what the source of that water is. I know that's a carbonated and flavored water, but you just have to look on the bottle and see if it's from just filtered municipal water, if it's from RO water from a municipal supply. I know Topo Chico is supposedly that's from a spring in Mexico. Professor Conant mentioned Mexico maybe having naturally higher levels of fluoridation. But, Paul, what say you in regards to those?
This is one of the issues, of course, is the multiplier effect. Once you put fluoride in the drinking water, it's not just the communities that drink the fluoridated water. It's communities that may not be fluoridated, but they're drinking soft drinks, beer, other products, which are made in communities where the water is fluoridated. And also with processed foods, where a lot of the water, a lot of the food that's processed, the water's driven off of steam, et cetera, et cetera. So you get fluoride in all kinds of products. So if you stop the fluoridation of the water, you would stop those extra sources as well. There is some good news out there. For example, some of the popular coffee-making stores selling, like Starbucks, they use reverse osmosis water. They don't want any possible taste from local water supplies to interfere with the taste of coffee that they're proud of. So my understanding is that they don't use the tap water. They purify it first of all. And maybe other producers are doing that as well. But the only way to find out if you've got a favorite brand is to check them. Check their 800 numbers and ask them.
Yep. Well, let's go back. Paul, you were going to backtrack to some studies, I believe.
Yes. I was going to say that back in 2003, the EPA asked the National Academy of Sciences to review the toxicology of fluoride in water. They wanted a review to see if their safe drinking water standards were safe. And, of course, they're not. Their 4 parts per million is by no means safe. But anyway, they went through this process, and the NAS came back with the National Research Council. They selected a 12-membered team. 3 were pro-incineration, 3 were anti, 6 were undeclared. They thought they'd get this report done in a year. It took them 3.5 years. It ended up being the most thorough review of the toxicology of fluoride ever done. And it was, as I said, it was balanced, which was very important. Because so often when governments ask for reviews of fluoride or fluoridation, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The agency comes back with the endorsement of government policy. But not in this case. And in fact, they didn't look at any of the benefits of water fluoridation, just the looking at the toxicity of fluoride at any level. And what they came back and said to the EPA is your 4 parts per million safe drinking water standard is not safe, and you should do a risk assessment to determine a new safe level. That was 2006. We are still, Ben, living with that 4 parts per million so-called safe drinking water standard. And many, many of the studies that have found a lowering of IQ in China were at levels less than 4 parts per million. So we've known now for nearly 20 years that the so-called safe drinking water standard in the United States was lowering IQ of children in China. So it's utterly irresponsible, the dragging of the feet of the EPA. And I'm not quite sure the motives of the EPA here. It's a smaller agency than the NIH, the National Institute of Health. And National Institute of Health is huge. EPA is small. NIH policy, ever since U.S. Public Health Service endorsed fluoridation in 50, has been to promote fluoridation. Okay. Now to the studies, and again, this is interesting irony here, because these important studies I'm talking about, most of them were funded by the NIH. That means that the methodology must have been pretty good. When researchers go to the NIH for money, they have to show protocols which are good, very good, because we're talking millions of dollars of subsidies here. Anyway, in 2017, the first of these studies, the so-called BASHASH study, is a team of researchers from Canada, the United States, and Mexico. They looked at the exposure of pregnant women to fluoride, obviously during pregnancy. The way they did that was to measure the archived urine samples for fluoride. And the urine samples are good because they're independent of the source of fluoride. It doesn't matter whether you get your fluoride from toothpaste or food or water or wherever. The total exposure will show up in your urine. That's a measure of total exposure. And it means also that you can compare the results with, say, Mexico City, where the main source of fluoride is fluoridated salt, with, say, New York City, where the main source of fluoride is from fluoridated water, because what you would be looking at is the level of fluoride in the urine of those women in the respective cities. Anyway, what they found was a very strong relationship between the level of fluoride in the mother's urine during pregnancy and the IQ of the offspring, measured at both 4 and again from 6 to 12. Very striking result, very strong result, and they controlled for every confounding variable that you can think of. The first response of the ADA was this, oh, well, this is Mexico City, this isn't the United States. But again, they ignored the fact that they were looking at urine levels. And within a few months, a study was published in Canada which showed that the average level of fluoride in the urine of pregnant women in Canada was, on average, the same as the level in the Mexico City. So in Mexico City, it was 0.91 parts per million in the urine. In Canada, it was 0.87 in the fluoridated communities. That's almost identical. Also interesting is that the level of urine in the fluoridated communities was approximately twice the level of urine in the non-fluoridated communities, indicating that fluoridated water is a very significant source of fluoride in, say, Canada and the United States. And then whilst that was going on, in 2019, a study from Canada showed, and this was published, and this is very important, I'm sure it interests you, it was published in JAMA Pediatrics, which is the leading journal of pediatrics in the world. So all pediatricians now should have been warned that there's a strong relationship between the level of fluoride in mother's urine during pregnancy and the IQ of their children. Now, in the case of the Canadian study, they found the relationship with boys, but with not with girls in terms of the urine. But when they looked at other measures of exposure of the women, namely the levels of fluoride in their water or the calculation of total dose, these did relate to the lowering of IQ. So these are very important studies. And one more I must mention.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I can get this in.
Yes.
In 2020, another study from Canada showed that there was a lowering of IQ between, listen to this, between children who, when they were babies, were bottle-fed in fluoridated communities and children who, when they were babies, were bottle-fed in non-fluoridated communities. So the only difference between these children, as best we could see, is that one set was bottle-fed with fluoridated tap water, the other was bottle-fed with non-fluoridated tap water. Lowering of 9 IQ points. That's
wow.
Incredible finding. Incredible finding.
Can you speak to, and we can go a few minutes past the top of the hour, too, because we started late, but could you speak to, obviously, lowering the IQ is a major problem, especially 9 points. But what are some other, I've heard you speak about thyroid and pineal gland and maybe ADD or some.
The thyroid gland is incredibly important. You know, when the fetus comes into existence, it has no thyroid gland. It's totally dependent upon the mother's level of thyroid hormones for its fetal development. You know, the whole of fetal development is essentially controlled by the level of thyroid hormones in terms of the growth of each tissue. So it's totally dependent on the mother. If the mother is hyperthyroid, then immediately that's going to translate into lowered IQ in the offspring. So there is your first, possibly strongest mechanism of how this is all happening. And yes, there are studies also that shows that fluoride accumulates, at least in the elderly pineal gland, and in animal studies, lowered melatonin production in animals associated with fluoride exposure. So not too much scientific evidence there, but certainly a huge, huge worry. But in terms of the IQ, the significance of IQ is that the levels that we are finding now with fluoride exposure are equivalent to the levels of lowering of IQ that was associated with lead was in gasoline. So what was sufficient to get lead out of gasoline right now is insufficient, apparently, to get fluoride out of the drinking water, as far as government agencies are concerned. It's extraordinary. And there is far more evidence today that fluoride lowers IQ in children than there was with lead in those days. The studies are far stronger than that.
Can you speak to, in the few minutes we have left, the other side, I think, the only other argument would be, well, we have to do this for the health of our teeth. So, I mean, obviously, even if it did help the teeth a lot, are we going to sacrifice the IQ and the brain for that? No,
well, I think
of course
the thing,
not,
this goes back to the very beginning. When I learned that, I mean, who in their right minds would think that protecting teeth is more important than protecting your child's brain? Unfortunately, there are two groups of people. There's a very, very large group of people who I believe would believe that protecting the brain is far more important than protecting the children's teeth. Not that you can't protect the teeth in other ways, than the group that believes protecting teeth is more important than protecting the brain. But the people that believe that preposterous notion that protecting the teeth is more important than protecting the brain are the ones with the power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why this bloody process has gone on for so long, Ben.
Yeah.
We're not against science, and we're not up against science. The science is on our side. We're up against power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That seems to be a common theme amongst a lot of topics that we discuss here when it comes to detrimental health policy in this country. But I've heard you talk about the studies that show any benefit to the teeth. It was like 0.6 out of all the different, like there's 150 edges of all of our teeth or something like that. And it was like a 0.6. That's the only potential benefit.
Yeah, this is the largest study of tooth decay in the United States. It was conducted by the National Institute of Dental Research, a big promoting agency for fluoridation. And they conducted the study. They looked at 39,000 children in the United States. And of the subsets of the 8,000 children that had grown up entirely in fluoridated communities versus the children who'd grown up their whole lives in non-fluoridated communities, the magnificent saving in tooth decay was 0.6 of one tooth surface. And now, obviously, the number of tooth surfaces increases as the child's teeth come out. By the time they've all come out, it's 128 tooth surfaces. So 0.6 of one tooth surface is pretty small compared to all those tooth surfaces. And for that, you would risk damaging the child's developing brain? It's crazy. It's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
And we have to stop it.
Yeah. Well, and I want to remind everybody, we talk about Weston A. Price a lot here, and he was a dentist in the 1920s, and he traveled the world studying indigenous tribes, 14 different people groups, over a 20-year period of time, documenting their health, including their dental health, and they had beautiful teeth with no cavities when they were not eating modern food, and modern food in his definition was sugar and processed flour. So I just want to remind people of that. Obviously, common sense tells us even that there's other ways to prevent cavities and besides exposing yourself to fluoride through the drinking water. Okay, Paul, that was a whirlwind of a tour through the history of fluoride and the policy and the big fight that you've really been leading the charge on, I would say, over the last many, many years. Congratulations on a job well done. It appears the court is set to rule in your favor.
We hope. I've given you our view of the judge's last words, but I think they're pretty revealing. I think he acknowledged our strongest suit, and he knocked down the EPA's attempt to make it all about causation rather than risk.
Right. Well, you would think the EPA and the CDC and all these government agencies would be working for our benefit and having our best interest at heart. But I'm with you. I think it boils down to that saving face. If they're shown to be wrong here, then the public lose faith and trust in all their policies across the board.
And the irony, Ben, the irony is the best way to regain that trust is to come clean, to admit that this is a mistake. All they need to say is this latest evidence. This is evidence that we knew nothing about in the 1950s when we started this. We knew nothing about this. This is new evidence. In the light of this new evidence, we will abandon this practice of putting it in the water. And instead, for those who want fluoride, we will advocate fluoridated toothpaste. I think most people would be forgiving if they come clean. But the longer they prolong this ridiculous practice, the less credibility they're going to have. It's silly.
I wholeheartedly agree. And it's a simple lesson that I teach my six children, my wife and I teach our kids, is fessing up. Confessing and asking for forgiveness goes a long way, and it's a sign of maturity that is so much more than just defending and denying and running from the truth. And
absolutely,
it's so absolutely healing to ask for forgiveness. Well, thank you, Paul, so much for spending the hour with us and for all your hard work. I encourage all the listeners to go to fluoridealert.org and join, be a member, follow everything that Paul and his group are doing, support them. And also, Paul, I want you to, once you get off, if you'll go tell your wife, thank you very much for putting those papers on your desk that day.
Okay, Ben, thanks very much indeed.
Okay, have a great day. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This has been Edwards. You're the Cure. That was Paul, Professor Paul Conant, fluoridealert.org. As always, another great show. I learned so much from these guests. It's awesome to be able to have them. And I appreciate all the listeners listening. I think the take-home message here is not only are you the cure, but you're responsible for getting educated and for using your discernment and for if you're going to believe like we believe at Veritas that the body was designed beautifully and will heal itself if you give it what it needs and avoid what it doesn't, you need to have a renewing of the mind. You need to know where your source of information is coming from and ultimately the source, which is your creator, and having discernment and communication with your creator through listening and through prayer. So be encouraged. All this chaos in the world right now hasn't knocked God off his throne. He's still sovereign, and his design is still beautiful. So trust the design. Steward your health by giving your body what it needs and avoiding what it doesn't. We'll be back next week with another great show. So y'all tune in, and we'll see you then. Ben Edwards, you're the cure.